Welcome to a new series of the G6 Podcast.
The G6 Podcast.
We are really excited to share a whole host of new features with you this season. Coming up, I speak to conductor David Ogden in Behind the Scenes, where we will be travelling around the UK to ask musicians about their local scenes and finding out how the cogs turn in different ways across the country. In a special report, Andrew tells us all about his adventures into the world of VR with Talis' virtual voice. But first, in an as-yet untitled segment, we meet those from all walks of life who are united by a love of classical music. And so I'm delighted to welcome our first guest, sports broadcaster Eleanor Aldroyd, to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Lovely to be with you.
So for our listeners who aren't as big sports fans as we are, particularly cricket, could you tell us a bit about what you do?
Well, I work for mostly BBC Radio 5 Live, and I have covered sport for them for, 30 years, actually. It's extraordinary to think it's my 30th anniversary working in the sports department. So I do things like I go to the Olympic Games, so I present programmes from big sporting events. I cover cricket, so I'm reporting on, currently reporting on the India-England series, but from back home, of course. And I've done that for a long time. So I've done bits of commentary over the years on a range of different sports, usually at the Olympics, like synchronized swimming and modern pentathlon and some of the more obscure sports as well. But I've been very, very fortunate in my life to cover pretty much every major sporting event going, I think, almost without exception. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful life and career, and I just feel incredibly privileged to do it, really.
Yeah, I've caught up with one of your sort of 3 o'clock in the morning starts from, I think it was from Sri Lanka most recently, actually. That was rather enjoyable.
Normally the joy of actually working on a series overseas is that you're there, so you're not having to deal with ridiculously early wake-up calls and time differences, But actually doing that, covering that for Radio 5 Live on the Sri Lanka series meant that I was getting up, making myself a cup of tea, doing it from my bedroom, as I've done pretty much all my broadcasting in the last year. But then living that experience of the fans who are waking up and listening to it and watching it as well at that time in the morning. So in a way, you're trying to convey the idea of being in Gaul when actually it's a freezing cold London day with the rain rattling on my skylight above my head.
And through your association, you're the First Lady of Fighting Talk.
Not my title. That is literally true, because I was the first who was brave enough to go on it.
Gosh, okay. It's been going for nearly 20 years, that series, hasn't it?
It's been going for a long time, yes. Yeah. I was going to say 15 years, but you may well be right. It may be heading towards 20 years, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoy listening to that. It's presented by Colin Murray, and they have a podcast extra segment. And that's when I first discovered that you have a passion for choral music. So when did you realise that you had this passion?
Well, it started, I suppose, because my father was a vicar, mostly of two reasonable sized parishes in the Hereford Diocese, so in South Shropshire and then in Herefordshire. And when I was, I suppose, sort of 6, 7, 8, my brothers, who are both younger than me, and I were co-opted into the choir at church. And I think this was just to kind of distract us and give us something to do. And because, we had to go to church, there was no choice in the matter at that stage, partly because we were too young to be left at home on our own. And my mother obviously had to be in church as well as the vicar's wife and support, even though she had a career of her own and was a teacher and one languages teacher. So I suppose I started then, and it just sort of seeps into your bones in a way, doesn't it? When you're that young, you suddenly think, you start to really absorb the hymn tunes. And we didn't do a lot of high day and holiday singing. We didn't do evensong or anything like that. It was kind of Sunday morning bashing out the hymns. But you start to get that repertoire of hymns, ancient and modern, revised in your head. And actually then when I was about 16, my father moved to a different parish in Herefordshire, in Ledbury. And they had a beautiful church. It is a beautiful church in Ledbury. But the choir there was boys only. So I was, suddenly found myself with no singing to do. When I was at school, I failed to get into the school choir, which is still something which you know, really niggles me to this day.
What happened?
I think I must have done a really shockingly bad audition, I suspect. But it knocked my confidence, and it kind of knocked my confidence for years and years and years, because it made me think, well, maybe I can't sing. Maybe I haven't got a voice after all. And I did a bit of singing at university. So I went to Cambridge and joined a couple of choral societies there. And mostly what happened, the main thing I did at Cambridge was actually just stalk the great choirs at Cambridge. So my great friend Isenda Maxton Graham and I used to go and sit in King's Chapel and just kind of, I mean, in a fairly innocent way, stalk the choral scholars. So I don't know if you've come across the brilliant bass at Christopher Purvis.
Oh, yes.
Who is a choral scholar in our time.
Big fans.
Yes, amazing voice. This extraordinary shock of dark hair he had when he was a student, and he just had that charisma, and we were just mesmerized.
Ah.
so that really inspired a love as a listener, as a follower, you know, and what better setting was there to really get involved in that. Right. So that was it. And then I just fell out of it for years and years and years, and gradually in the last few years got back into it through my daughters being in our local church choir. And so that's when I rejoined and it started all over again.
Amazing. So when do you find yourself listening to music, and do you have any favourite artists or composers?
Well, I'd say I listen to music for most of the day these days. You know, I think particularly in this last year when we've all been slightly rationing our news consumption. And so I might listen to the breakfast programme on Radio 5 Live, and then I will put on Radio 3, and it can often be Radio 3 for the whole of the rest of the day, you know, all the way through from Essential Classics to Sean Rafferty, and then the brilliant InTune mixtape, which I love. So that's the thing that I find, you know, I've found in my life in the last year has been a huge benefit from a mental health point of view, as well as just simply enjoyment. But I've also been involved in the last few years with our local church music festival in Barnes in Southwest London. I don't know if you've had anything to do with that at all, but
yes. Well, I've seen the fantastic work they've been doing down there. And actually, you wrote a book for them a few years ago, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes, I got it. This was one of these things. It's a little bit like after I failed my audition for the choir at school. I've always had a certain sense of imposter syndrome when it comes to you know, a lot of things, but classical music particularly. And I played the piano at school, and I got to grade 7 at the piano, and so, you know, but I've got very small hands. If I hold my hands up, you can probably see that I've got tiny, tiny hands.
Oh yeah, okay. So you're not from Rachmaninoff then.
No, definitely not. I could only just about stretch an octave, but not with a third at the bottom end.
Okay.
I just
sellotapes and pencils and this sort of.
That's what it could be. That is the thing I'm going to have to rediscover my long lost.
A bit percussive.
Percussive. That's very true. So the Barnes Music Festival thing I got involved with because the theme for 2016 was composers of Barnes. So Handel and composers of Barnes. Handel's first home in London was at Barn Elms, which was a big house. That was his first registered home when he first came over in 1712, I think. Mm. So this big estate, which is no longer a house there. There's playing fields there at Barn Elms. Okay. But so he was the first composer of Barnes. Then Gustav Holst had a house on the terrace, sort of along the river, so between the High Street and Barnes Bridge Station, which I walk past every day and think, oh, goodness me, Gustav Holst lived here. So when he first became director of music at St. Paul's Girls' School, Herbert Howells lived pretty much his entire married life in Barnes.
Yeah.
And I walk past the bottom of his garden on a regular basis when I'm, you know, walking the dog. And then you've got people like Roxana Panufnik, who lives in Barnes, and Howard Goodall as well. So it's quite a good and eclectic mix of people, of composers who've lived in Barnes. So the theme was composers of Barnes. And they commissioned a book, and quite late on in the process, so in October before the festival in February, the person who was supposed to be writing the book suddenly discovered that they hadn't got enough time because they're a busy musician.
Oh, no.
And so they looked around and thought, who have we got who could put together a book which no work has been done? Aha, we have a journalist in our midst. And because at that point, I was already singing in the choir at St. Mary's. So I knew Dan Turner, who was the artistic director of the festival. And so I had basically 3 months to, interview. I fortunately could interview Howard and Roxana, but yep. then starting
Gustav
from
was
scratch.
Unavailable for comment.
Gustav was not available for comment. No, but the problem was Handel. Handel was the big beast in every sense, because say he had that connection with Barnes, but it's literally one sentence in one biography right. of Handel written sometime in the 19th century, which talks about his connection to Barn Elms. And so to write a whole chapter about Handel with a link to Barnes was quite a challenge for somebody who is not a music historian, you know, or a musicologist or anything like that.
You're sort of just painting a lovely picture.
Well, I did. I did a lot of stuff about what London would have looked like and what Barnes would have looked like in yeah. the early 18th century.
Handel's inspirations.
You know, so maybe the river, yeah. exactly. Maybe it was, you know, it was walking along the river, you know. Yeah, and of course, the yeah. water music was about that time as well, or just after he was living yeah. in Barnes. So yeah, it was. But I then had to submit this. It was like being back at Cambridge, because I had to submit the chapter to Donald Burrows, who's one of the leading Handel. Yes. Experts okay. in the country. He was quite kind.
What
about
mark
it.
Did he get?
I think I probably scraped a 2.2.
No, okay, no, fine. But it's in print and it's available.
But it's
now.
In print. It's in print. Absolutely. It's actually also in the library at the Handel House.
Oh, cool.
You know, okay. in the Foundling Museum, because they have a wonderful Handel library there. So as I say, I did feel like a huge imposter going in there and researching among this vast library of Handel memorabilia.
So you've mentioned that you have felt this imposter syndrome a couple of times now. Is that why, do you think, classical music is perceived by some as inaccessible? Because there's this view that if you don't know enough about it, then you can't understand it.
Mm. I think so. I think there is something that puts people off who have not been brought up in it. And, you know, because I grew up in it, and both my parents loved classical music and we listened to it a lot at home. And, you know, they both sang in consort groups as well. As well as, you know, teaching and yeah. and vicaring, and you know, my father was a good tenor, my mother was an alto, so I did grow up in that, but I think you know, a lot of it probably goes down to schools, but I think everybody at school does some classical music or does some music, and by defining it as classical music, maybe it puts people off, but I think in a way it's almost there's a this business of being a sports broadcaster and somebody who loves classical music, you know, there is almost this disconnect, and people think, how can you like both? And I was remembering actually that a few years ago I did a program for Radio 3, and it was, I think it was the Free Thinking Festival at Gateshead, and they set up this discussion between a panel of Radio 3 experts and then me and two other sports people, and it was sport versus the arts. And the idea was to try and argue that one was greater than the other, or one was more deserving of being taken seriously than the other.
Right.
and in a way, the panel that I had, so I had Pat Nevin, the ex-Scotland footballer,
brilliant. Yeah.
and Matthew Syed, the Olympic table tennis player. And we were all desperate to just get our cultural credentials out there and talk about our love of, you know, visual arts and literature and music. And the people on the Radio 3 panel were determined to be as snooty as they possibly could be about sport.
Oh, no.
And as if it was a completely wasteful and pointless pastime. So, I mean, I don't know how you've experienced this, whether, you know, as somebody who is a trained classical musician who loves sport, do people look down on that at all? Have you found?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, we as a group enjoy watching, playing cricket especially. Not everyone, it's not a sort of prerequisite for joining the group. It's not like that at all. Actually, it just sort of happened. It was something that we...
You can only join if you're a very good counter tenor and you can bowl leg spin.
he's a medium pace bowler actually, but he'll tell me off for saying that as well, because he thinks he's fast. Anyway, but it's just a great thing to do, just to sort of blow off steam between rehearsals. But we don't think of it as sort of any less it's sort of important than what we do. It builds us up as sort of friends and colleagues, and while it's not our sort of, you know, it's not what we're trained in, it's something else we're passionate about. And I think that the more sort of passionate you are about anything that you are involved with, surely the sort of more enriched your life becomes. And so I'm sorry, I saw you'd done that interview, and I'm sorry that it was such a sort of bad experience.
Yes, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I don't think that I felt as if I was being looked down upon by the producers or by the presenter. It was just more the guests. It was just sort of illustrating a sense that actually there is something that is a bit lowbrow about sport. But actually, the choral music cricket link. I had one of the funnest, most fun things I did during the first lockdown was to write a piece for the Night Watchman Cricket Quarterly about that very thing about choirs and choral and cricket, so choral music and cricket. And this was based on nothing really. I mean, because obviously you and I had been in touch by that stage about fighting talk, so I knew you were a sports fan. I'm good friends with Ben Collingwood, who produces Choral Evensong for Radio 3, who is a huge cricket fan and also, you know, an ex chorister and choral scholar. And so I pitched, and of course Sir Alistair Cook, you know, England's most successful ever test run scorer, who was a chorister at St Paul's Cathedral. And so I thought, well, that's enough. I've got the makings of a piece here, and I need something to stop the boredom during the lockdown. And so I pitched this to our to the editor of the Night Watchman, a chap called Matt Thacker, and he said, oh yes, that's a brilliant idea. He said, we play every year against a team called Fair Is the 11. Run by Alex Stobbs.
Yes.
And they have this angelic looking fast bowler come tenor who decimates us every year, and who is Rory Bowen. Were you contemporary with Rory Bowen at Cambridge?
But I know him, and in fact I have played cricket with him, and he is lethal. Right.
Well, Alex told me that he tries to avoid, he never opens the bowling with Rory because he's too good, and there's no fun in it if the other side is just bowled out for 25, having had Rory rip through their entire batting lineup. And of course he grew up in Hereford, and his father Geraint is director of music at Hereford Cathedral, which is where my parents retired to Hereford, and they became very sort of involved in the life of the cathedral. My father was a prebendary of the cathedral as well for a while, and actually we held his funeral at the cathedral. You know, not everyone gets to have their funeral at the cathedral. So,
wow.
And I will always have that the end of the service. So the end of the service, we had the Durufle in Paradisum. Which is such a beautiful piece, and the cathedral just filled with incense. And my father wasn't high church really at all; he was kind of, I'd say, medium church. But that extraordinary music and the smell of the incense, and I just thought, oh, Dad would absolutely have loved this. And it made such a difficult day, a really sad day, feel joyous, because actually to be in the cathedral was a very, very special thing. And the choir at Hereford are lovely. I mean, they're just such a brilliant choir.
Oh, it's wonderful that music can do that, can't it? It can make the saddest of occasions actually very, almost uplifting. So, yeah.
Uplifting, yeah, definitely.
I was going to ask if, and you touched on this, but if there are any other ways where you find music and sport to combine?
Well, I suppose it's this, I mean, going back to the choir and cricket piece I wrote, it was this idea of being part of a team. You know, if you are in a team sport, it is like being in a choir in a way, because obviously, you know, in a cricket team, you're going to have individual performances. So you know, in cricket has individuals in an overall entity of the team. So as I think Ben put it in the piece that I wrote, it's a bit like if you have a solo in a choir, you know, you're like the batsman who's going out to bat, and you might score a century. You know, you might have that, you know, whatever your favourite solo is. And actually, one of the other pieces that we had at my father's funeral was the Stanford in G, Nunc Dimittis, with that wonderful baritone solo at the start.
Yes.
But then, so, you know, you've got your soloist, but you've got to be part of that blended mix of the choir. You know, you can't be too much of an individual. And I always think that Kevin Peterson, who was one of my heroes and responsible for one of my greatest days at a test match ever in 2005, when, you know, we won the Ashes back from Australia and he scored a ridiculous century and completely destroyed the Aussies. But he famously never quite fitted into that team, that England team. You know, he was always a bit of an outlier in that team. And I always think that if he had been a golfer or a tennis player, we would have appreciated him as the sporting genius he undoubtedly is, but because he was in a team sport, it was much, much harder for him to be appreciated, because he was a disruptor really within the team rather than a team player. And it's, I suppose, you know, every choir has the person who is always a bit too loud, you know.
we have to work on that sometimes.
Yes, but. Yes, the dominant soprano that we all
know.
We've
got a couple of them.
Yeah. So I think that is. It's very interesting to hear Alistair Cook talking about his experience as a chorister, because, you know, he didn't come from a particularly musical background. You know, I think his parents loved music, but they weren't, you know, that. In that traditional going to church, singing in choirs, loving choral music way. But because he was picked up from his local school choir to then try out for choir schools in London and then got into the St. Paul's choir. And then as a result of being a chorister, tried out for a music scholarship at Bedford School, and Bedford had a great cricket tradition as well. So he learnt to play cricket as a result, really, of being a chorister. And I mean, that's an extreme example, but he talks about the way that he learned to deal with pressure, and the discipline of playing top level sport is like the discipline. You know, when you think you're an 8-9 year old child learning the discipline of psalm singing, and, you know, learning amazing anthems and traveling as well, and the having to be there on time, and, you know, having to concentrate, that level of concentration taught him a great deal about being a great batsman and occupying the crease, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. Alistair Cook's one of those sort of fairly high profile people that we as choral musicians kind of know, loves, you know, grew up in that tradition. Is there anyone else who you work with who we might not know has a passion for choral music?
Gosh, that's a very good question, actually, because I did look around and I wondered about that. And I don't think there's anybody I've come across who is a choral musician. You're trying to tap me up for possible future interviews, aren't you?
Here? Well, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking that this segment might have a short shelf life if we can't find more people.
Yeah, I can't think of any specific cricket or football people. I'm sure there must be some out there, actually. I'm sure there must be. Because it's not so unusual. If I think of some, as soon as we stop talking, I will think,
absolutely.
You know, the love of cricket is a fairly niche thing. I mean, you know, lots of people love cricket, and it's the passion that it inspires as well. And the sort of the nerdishness as well, and the desire to, you know, learn about everything there is to know about, I don't know, you know, Wally Hammond, for example, or Clary Grimmett, or to say, oh, well, yes, well, you know, you should learn this bit of Palestrina. It's just so amazing.
Yeah,
and it's, there is some sort of, you know, one-upmanship that you get with sports fans and music fans as well, I think.
100%. And then we all keep scorecards on our performances as well, just to monitor progress. Well, thank you so much, Ellie, for joining us, for being our first guest on this segment. I think just before we go, I wanted to just read you a couple of ideas that we've had for titles for this segment. Maybe you could tell us what you think. Mm-hmm. So we've had Singing from the Same Hymn Sheet.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, that's a no then. Okay.
Yeah, no. It's not very punchy.
Okay. Vocal point.
Vocal point.
Like focal point.
Okay. Yeah, well, the fact you've had to explain it to me maybe suggests...
No, that's terrible. Okay, here's another one. How about preaching to the choir?
Yes, I quite like that. I do quite like that.
That's not
bad. No, preaching to the choir is quite.
That was
nice.
One of Mike's suggestions. Well, we'll put it back to the planning committee and. Okay. But with your recommendation.
I will come. Yeah, absolutely. I will. You know, I may come up with some again. You know, l'esprit de l'escalier. You know, I'll probably come up with some as I finish the podcast, and I'll ping them over to you if so.
Well, who knows? Maybe you could join us next time we're in Herefordshire, playing at the cricket ground at Michael Church. Eskley is a rather beautiful spot.
Ah, lovely. Yeah, there are some beautiful cricket grounds there.
Yeah, well, normally we're relegated to the basketball court round the corner from where we rehearse, but it's really good to be able to blow off a bit of steam after a rehearsal.
It's just, yeah, there is definitely something which, you know, as you say, the letting off of steam. It's, you know, it's the endorphins, isn't it? It's the endorphins of singing. It's the endorphins of sport that that we all love and we've all missed so much this year.
Now it's time for Behind the Scenes, where we find out more about the individuals who are instrumental in the inner workings of their local choral scene. I'm delighted to welcome our first guest, the wonderful David Ogden, to talk about what makes him and the singers in his area tick. Hello, David.
Oh, hello, Owen. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thank you for being our first guest.
Oh, no, pleasure. No.
So tell us about what you do and where you do it.
Oh, right. OK, well, I'm... and I've been in Bristol for about 30 years, which is a long, long time, building up, I suppose, what you could say, a career as a choral conductor and as a conductor of lots of different ensembles. And I think probably one of the strengths of the city is, people have called it a singing city, which is great because there's probably about over 100 choirs here. And there's so much diversity in the choirs. You know, you've got everything from... little junior singers, like called the mini singers, to lots of community choirs as well. You know, I mean, there's one called the Gert Lush choir, which is a Gert Lush is a Bristolian kind of word, which means really, really good. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, there's even a choir called the Choir Brigade, which is probably the best title of a choir ever. but there's also lots of concert choirs as well. Five or six really big choirs that are kind of singing lots of the oratorios, but also the major choral works. But it's a really good training ground for young people. And then there's the church choirs, you know, the cathedral, St. Mary Redcliffe, and, you know, a church you know really well, Owen.
Yeah, church I know well, yeah.
That's right. Also Westbury-on-Trym, where I'm director of music. So, you know, a wide range of music. Not forgetting, actually, the workplace choirs as well. The one that I run a choir, Airbus, and at Royal Mail, and also at Sorday Publishing. So, yeah, you know, all different varieties of music making.
A choir for everyone, you might say. And I think the most amazing thing, well, that I know about you, and I think everyone would be fascinated, is the fact that you list all those choirs that are in Bristol, but you manage to run, what, 90% of them? So how on earth do you manage to have such a monopoly? No, but you run a choir, you know, normal times, basically every evening, sometimes two. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, the obviously, how do I do it? I suppose it's people have asked me to run them. And I think, I mean, particularly with the workplace choirs, you know, they often operate at lunchtime, you know, so I can easily... kind of schedule my work in the mornings and then run that at lunchtime and then a bit of work in the afternoon and then a rehearsal in the evening. It's not a 9-to-5 job, you know, as you know, music's not a 9-to-5 job, but also my chamber choir, Exultati Singers, you know, they're really top-notch singers. Lots of people have been choral scholars in the past and really good sight readers and enjoy performing music to a very high level. So it's people audition for me, you know, different choirs, and I kind of say, yes, you'll be brilliant in that choir or that choir, you know. So actually having that variety, I think that really helps, you know. So that keeps it fresh and keeps it energised and keeps your brain ticking, because you have to kind of adapt to what that person in that particular choir needs at the time and just get them kind of, you know, hopefully get them better. The function of the choirs is to find a purpose for them, is to, like with the community choirs, you know, it's easy to set up a choir. Anybody can set up a choir, as Gareth Malone has shown, you know, but it's actually the continuity of how you do it and what their function is. So, for instance, with the workplace choirs like Airbus and the Royal Mail, we've been used as kind of promotional tools for them to raise money or to entertain clients or whatever it might be.
Well, I remember visiting Abbey Road with you, I don't know how, 8 years ago or something?
Oh, yes.
Just that.
You did.
Well, I've still got the T-shirt.
You did? I've still got that pitch. Yeah.
Because you gave me a Royal Mail outfit, didn't you, for recording, just to make sure it would fit in.
Just in case you might need it, you can now deliver the post around London. I mean, that was a kind of wild and wacky thing that we did with the Royal Mail Choir. I mean, that again was to raise money for their particular charity. With Airbus, we've done we've raised money for them, but also to promote Airbus events. We went to Farnborough Air Show and sang there on a massive plane. I can't remember the name of the plane, 380 or whatever it was. But, you know, some really wild and wacky things, which is great to do. With the Sordid Choir, which was a bit more environmentally friendly, we sang in a solar-powered shed in this Bristol city centre, I seem to remember, to promote a Green Week that was happening in Bristol, because Bristol is a very green city. So yeah. It's finding a kind of function and using the choir to kind of, you know, promote, not only to enrich the singers, but also to give them and lots of people experiences.
Yeah, and as you say, Bristol is such a vibrant city. And I was going to ask if you had a favourite local venue, and I suppose, is it not the solar panelled shed?
Well, the solar power shed's not there anymore. I think it's probably destroyed on the Friday night kind of revellers. I think St George's has got to be the favourite venue, St George's in just off Park Street. It's kind of big enough to do things with orchestra, and it's also small enough and to be intimate, so that you really get a sense that the audience is really around the singers and really listening. I mean, you can get some beautiful silences because it's often used as a recording studio, so it's really, really beautiful silence. And so at the end of a piece, you can actually feel the audience listening. And what's also great about it is that you can also put, you know, a small group of little singers of children or whatever in there, and it'll sound fantastic. And then you can put a large group choruses, art and orchestra in there, and it'll also sound fantastic, as long as you don't use too many trombones. There is a limit. Brahms' Requiem is just about the limit. Anything beyond that, it'll blow the roof off.
You have
off.
To move to the Bristol Beacon, I suppose.
Bristol Beacon, yeah, that's going to be very exciting. That's when that's open. You know, being quite involved in that, because the youth choirs that I run are very much part of, they were the choirs in residence at the Colston Hall, and they're going to be the choirs in residence at Bristol Beacon. So, we're looking at lots of new and exciting ideas for that when that opens.
And yeah. So do you have a favourite memory from your past sort of 30-odd years of performing in Bristol? Is there anything that really, you know, comes to mind? Do you think, that was a very special day?
There's so many. Am I allowed to say two?
Well, of course.
Two very, very contrasting ones. Okay. One is with City of Bristol Choir, I was commissioned to go on to the building site that was Cabot Circus. I don't know if you took part in this, or this was before or after your time, but anyway, Cabot Circus is our shopping centre, big shopping centre. I was commissioned to go there and record songs from the workers. The workers came from 53 different countries. And so I kind of went up the, you know, cranes and God knows what, and recorded these songs. And they were basically folk songs, or they were songs that were in the heart of the workers. And then I arranged them, and we, City of Bristol Choir, sang them in hard hats in the shell of the House of Fraser store before it was open. And then we moved from there to St James Priory, which is another of my favourite venues, the oldest building in Bristol. And we sang those songs to the workers that had sung them. And they were so powerful, because you can imagine, for instance, one lady from Hungary who'd, she was working in the canteen. And see, she sang this song and, you know, she'd left all her family behind to come and work at this place, and we sang her a Hungarian lullaby that she'd sung to her children, you know. And I mean, the emotion behind that and the kind of connection was amazing. And that was, I could have made that into a kind of Cabot Circus cantata, but it was more than that, because it was about drawing the stories from these people to kind of create this cathedral of commerce, if you like, in the centre of Bristol. I mean, those people are probably back in their countries now, but it was this kind of legacy. Mm. And actually a recent one, you might mention one, but there's so many, was with Exultati singers.
There's and too many.
And the saxophonist Amy Dixon, which we did in February 2020. So it was one of the last concerts that happened in Bristol.
Just before,
And we commissioned five pieces, actually, for that that concert. Roderick Williams and Toby Young and Eric Whittaker did an arrangement of one of his pieces for choir and sax. So it was. I mean, she's a great player, just so effervescent and lively. And you thought, actually, why haven't more people written for this? There we go. There's a job for you this afternoon. Written for that combination.
There's a saxophonist called Sam Corkin, and he's doing a project which involves quite a few composers for saxophone in Canterbury Cathedral Choir.
Oh, right.
So hopefully we'll be able to have him on and talk to him about that. But what that should do, hopefully, is create a bit more of a resource for someone like programming for that sort of thing. So there's a lot of commissioning work to be done, which you've started. And the audiences in Bristol like that to be challenged, or do you find it hard to program this new music?
Well, I tend to be a bit quite canny. You won't surprise you. But we've, for instance, we set up a concert called Sense of the Divine about 10 years ago. And that's a kind of brand. It doesn't really mean much, but it means you can do religious music and non-religious music together. But it kind of has a focus, which is, if you like, a secular focus. So we kind of shoehorned new music in, if you like. So, for instance, the concert is not necessarily about, another composer with nobody's heard of, but actually it's about a theme. And as long as you kind of structure it so it's not all unfamiliar, or as there's a story behind it, I think people will listen. And different people will take different things from it, won't they? Some people will think, God, that was amazing. Some people think, oh, I didn't really like that. And they're very loyal as well, which is great. And, all choirs really get kind of good audiences. I'm not sure choirs are very good at going to concerts. Singers are very good at going to concerts of other choirs.
Yeah, quite.
At one point in Bristol, we did have choir wars. It's not so much that now, but, everybody's very supportive. And I think after, when they finally get back, they'll be even more supportive.
Yeah, and I think that sounds... Well, that is something that I think you've helped to build over your sort of career in Bristol. So for those that maybe want to start singing or have a little bit of experience, could you offer one piece of advice to, if they're in Bristol and they want to join a choir, what should they do?
Well, you can Google choirs in Bristol. I mean, I think probably it's finding one which is, at your particular level, and obviously because some of them will be auditioning and some of them won't be. So you've got to work out whether you want an audition. And that's if you don't want to audition, if you just started, then, maybe join a community choir. But then quite a lot of the community choirs have different sections, for different levels. And also stick at it, actually, because that's what thing I'm trying to communicate with the young people particularly, is that, it's not always fun. We try and make it fun as much as possible, but there is a lot of hard work to be able to achieve, as Owen, achieve things, and sometimes you think, oh, I don't want to go to that rehearsal, but actually you have to just go and keep the routine going and keep practicing your singing. So and find a community. Sorry, you asked me for one thing, didn't you? But I'm no good at one thing.
It's fascinating.
Find a community that you want to be with, some people you want to be with, because the choirs are social things. And with the City of Bristol Choir at the moment, we're doing the Messiah, you see, because actually probably about half of the singers in it haven't sung the Messiah before. So I thought that'd be a really good thing to do because it's got some good tunes, it's in English, and there's lots of recordings and what have you, and rehearsal tapes and that people can listen to if necessary. And of course, then some people say, well, I've sung the Messiah 43 times, I don't want to sing it anymore. But actually, what we're doing is getting those people I volunteered them to sing the lines, if you like, to teach the other people, you know, to say, this is a legacy. You've sung it 43 times. That person hasn't sung it at all. Your job is to teach them it.
Great.
You know,
yeah.
Because that's your legacy to pass on, because they are the, otherwise, if we don't do that, there'll be nobody singing the Messiah in, you know, 100 years.
Well, thank you, David, so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
It's been really interesting to hear all about the music scene in Bristol. Of course, I know it well, and I look forward to seeing you for a curry before too long.
Oh, yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Curry houses are good in Bristol as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we should do another segment on that. That's the next one. Yeah. Brilliant.
Are we finished?
Yeah, we're all done. See you soon. Now it's time for a special report on a project called Talis's Virtual Voice, which has been masterminded by our very own second countertenor, Andrew Leslie Cooper. And Andrew's here to tell us a little bit about the project. So, Talis's Virtual Voice, what is it?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that I masterminded it, Owen. I've certainly had a big role to play in this project, but this is a project that was conceived and sponsored by the Thomas Talis Society, which is a choir in London. It's a choir that also has a sort of a charitable side to it and a scholarly side to it. And the Talis Society is chaired by Nigel Press. And Nigel approached me after seeing some of my multi-track recordings earlier in the pandemic. And after hearing one of my choral pieces, he came to me with the idea of recording Sperminalium. And I thought this was just a ludicrous idea, and I didn't really give it much consideration at first. But as we got to talking, he told me how he was envisioning a project that was more than just a recording of Sperminalium. It was a project to sort of elevate the accessibility of Sperminalium in the worldwide choral community. So my role to play in this project would be to record it, but then the project would take that recording and turn it into an educational resource for Sperminalium. So wherever you are in the world, you could log on to this web tool and you could hear my recording and configure it and adapt it in a way that helps you to learn any of the 40 parts in Sperminalium. So with this tool, you'll be able to, you could isolate just one part and listen to it by itself, or you could isolate just one of the 8 choirs and listen to that by itself.
Wow.
You could listen to an organ accompaniment helping you, all sorts of things. There's nearly, I think, 1,000 of these listening options, different permutations of configuring the recording in order to learn the piece. But that's really the centerpiece of this whole project. Alongside that, there's a new edition of Sperminalium that's being published. It's an edition by Hugh Keat. This edition takes a sort of a fresh look at the piece, presents it in a slightly different way from what we're used to with the Philip Brett edition or the CPDL edition, for that matter. It presents it in 4 choirs of 10 voices rather than the traditional 8 choirs of 5 voices. It offers a wealth of background information to the piece, as well as Hugh's own sort of editorial, I don't know, flavorings, if you will, to help people's understanding of the notes on the page. So it's a really important resource that is long overdue, really, in the scheme of Sperminalium.
Awesome. That sounds really, really cool. And I guess this kind of journey started for you, actually, you were one of the very first sort of purveyors of the multi-track format when we went into lockdown with your rather wonderful videos of Pierce or Lair Garland comes to mind, mm-hmm. and the Sound the Trumpet by Purcell. How on earth do you set about making 1,000 different permutations just using your voice? Where do you begin?
Well, That's a good question. Well, it all starts in my living room, where I'm speaking to you from right now. I have a few pieces of audio equipment. I certainly don't have any fancy recording studio in my own home, but a few pretty good quality mics. And so I start with a guide track that I make on Sibelius. So I just type all the notes into Sibelius, make a guide track, and then have that going through my ears while I sing in my living room. So with SPEM, the whole recording process took about 3 months, just under 3 months. And I was sort of going through this Groundhog Day-esque routine where I'd wake up, do a bit of editing or do a bit of singing, get through one of the tracks, and then do some more editing or do some more singing later in the day, go to bed, repeat 3 months on the trot. And then at the end of that, there was a lot of mastering and sort of fine tweaking, shall we say, just to get everything lined up in sync and sort of equalized, sounding the way that I really wanted to, and sounding, well, as close to a real space as possible.
Yeah. And one of the coolest things about the project is that people can experience all of this technical wizardry in its final form by just going on Facebook or YouTube and plugging in their headphones, and they can watch you perform this piece in 360-degree video with that ambisonic texture. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? And they can do that without having any new technology themselves.
Exactly. However, if you did want to get a hold of a VR headset, you can immerse yourself even more into the 360-degree world. As I started out this project back in May, this was a pipe dream that I had. I knew that I wanted to have some sort of VR element to it. I had no idea how to go about doing this. And this the VR element of the project, that's the one part of the whole production that I didn't really do by myself. I came across this freelancer who lives in Slovenia. His name's Andrej Gregory. He's this 3D video wizard, and he put the video together for me. We selected this pre-existing 3D space, and it's this imaginary palace, sort of with columns and arches all over the place, and it's just this big oval room.
A representation of your living room in 360 degrees, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, that it's more or less exactly what my living room looks like. And we put green screen videos in the middle of this oval palace room, and he did the rest. He exported it as a 360-degree video and put all the lighting in. And we also had some fun with putting these little bits of floating music notation going through the room at different parts of the video. But I'm quite happy with how it's come out. Just for, little old me, without a great big video studio or without a great big recording studio, it's more than I ever could have hoped for. So I'm really happy with how it's come out. And now I've just got to try and get the word out to as many people as possible. So do check it out.
Absolutely, yeah. Please do check it out. And we'll do our bit to help share the good news. So recording all those parts and all the editing time you've had to put in, do you have any plans for a similar venture in the future?
I have no idea. I suppose my biggest hope would be that what's next is the pandemic comes to an end and I resume my normal working pattern, and I don't have time for these multi-track projects anymore. If I did have some time in the future moving forwards to do another project, I'd like to do something completely different. I'd like to do something, maybe something funny, maybe something comical.
Well, maybe doing Speminalium in A major would be comic, I suppose.
And that would be the end of my vocal cords.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Andrew, for letting us know about this. It's such an exciting project, and I really do urge everyone to check it out. It's called Telus's Virtual Voice. And alongside the amazing multi-track recording available in VR 360, there's also some fantastic educational resources alongside a new critical edition. So really it's a team effort. And it's lovely to see Andrew once on this call, but you can see him 39 more times in the video. So Telus's Virtual Voice. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you for joining us for this first episode of our second series. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us an email, podcast@theg6.co.uk, or you can find us on social media. See you next time.